ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
During the Second World War, a man named Walter Dexter was serving as the vicar of a church in West Footscray in Melbourne. Walter Dexter was in his 60s, and his attempts to take up a career as a farmer and a teacher had failed. And so he'd returned to his earlier vocation as a clergyman. Walter Dexter's kids regarded him as apathetic, not much of a trier. One of his frustrated kids called him a lazy vicar and even a born loser. But this quiet life Walter Dexter had been leading was utterly and totally at odds with his earlier life, which was full of adventure and travel and great danger. People who knew him then called him terribly brave and larger than life. Walter Dexter was 14 when he first boarded a ship at the end of the 19th century. And he'd seen Calcutta and New York and South Africa and Bombay and Tierra del Fuego while he was still a teenager. He became a military chaplain, and during World War I, his courage and compassion under fire made him the most decorated chaplain in Australian history. He was fierce in his defence and support of the common soldiers, and dearly loved by them for that. Historian Daniel Reno is here. Daniel has told the story of Walter Dexter in his new book, Sailor, Soldier, Vicar, Farmer, The Improbable Life of Anzac Chaplain Walter Dexter. Hello, Daniel.
Hi.
I fell in love with this man, incredibly good-hearted and curious and adventurous. The chief paradox seems to be this man who was regarded as a bit of a shambolic sort of mediocrity at the end of his life and this staggering earlier life that he'd had.
He's a curious combination of greatness and ordinariness. And I guess the first half of his life, or the first two-thirds, exhibits that greatness. But his children, who were born in later life, saw the quiet, mediocre side and couldn't understand the great.
The war historian C.E.W. Bean, war correspondent C.E.W. Bean, couldn't stand him. Just couldn't stand Walter Dexter. Bad-mouthed him again and again in his dispatches. Why was that?
Well, Dexter was kind of the opposite of what you'd expect out of an Anglican clergyman. Everyone said so. His children said so. He's the most unlikely Anglican clergyman you could come across. His seafaring background, his Northern English origins, meant that he didn't fit the stereotype of the polished, Oxbridge-educated Anglican clergyman. And, of course, Bean's father was an Anglican clergyman, a scholar. And Dexter was about as far removed from that as possible. And Bean kind of thought he was too vulgar.
He was too rough as guts and letting down the show. Like we're in the business of impressing the English or something. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I guess so. And it's so ironic in Bean, who was the champion of the bush Australian and the roughness. I mean, his history is a paean of praise to that image. Yet, up close and personal, he couldn't shake his background.
No, he came over all cucumber sandwiches and cups of tea with this lovely, rollicking man. He had a nickname, Walter Dexter. He was known as the Pinching Padre. How did he get that nickname?
He got it because of his extraordinary talent for acquiring, was the word he used, acquiring things that his men needed. Now, armies are marvels of logistics in getting the right thing to the right place at the right time. On the big scale, but on the smaller scale, they often fail their men terribly. And the chaplains, particularly Dexter, was adept at getting stuff. I mean, the staff at 1st Anzac Corps joked that he could go out in the morning in his shirts and shorts and come back in the evening with enough to supply an entire army corps. So, yeah, he just had this knack for pinching.
What would he procure for the men's enjoyment as opposed just the bare business of survival?
For enjoyment, I guess it was about making their lives more comfortable and more tolerable. Marquees to set up cinemas.
Cinemas?
Yes.
What, in France?
In France, yes.
How is he showing movies in the trenches at that time?
Not in the trenches.
Right.
a battalion, roughly 1,000 men at full strength, would spend about a third of its time in the trenches, rotating through the front line, the second line, and the reserve trenches. for about a month they'd spend there, and then 2 months would be out of the trenches, recovering, training, and they needed things to do, and they needed ways of unwinding after the stress of the trenches. And Dexter led the charge in creating cinemas behind the lines. He'd go to Paris, buy equipment, buy films, come back, set them up, and he would often pinch marquees from the YMCA. He acquired timber from an engineering unit to build seats for the soldiers to watch Charlie Chaplin and relax.
In writing this book, you met with his sole surviving son, Mick. How old was Mick when you met him to interview him?
He was just a few weeks off turning 100. It was an extraordinary experience. I mean, to meet the actual son of an Anzac soldier, an Anzac great. Yeah, it's never happened to me before, and I doubt it'll happen again.
What did he have to say about his father, though?
Mick had all the rebel qualities of his dad. He was his father's biggest critic. And Mick, who read the drafts of the book, says, yes, I suppose I am. But he admitted that his perspective was his alone. His brothers, for instance, would have different opinions of his father. And by the time he'd finished reading drafts of the book, he told me that he'd had to change his opinion of his dad on quite a few issues.
And Daniel, you're a man of faith. Why are you particularly interested in this crossover between religion in a time of war?
Well, I guess it's an undertold part of the Anzac story. The Anzac story is really important to Australians, but it's been presented almost exclusively, especially in its public form, as a secular narrative, as if the Anzacs weren't interested in religion. And yet, these soldiers were raised in the time when more Australians went to church than any period before or after. So there's a significant number have a religious background. And in my research, I found that up to a quarter of the soldiers were active in their faith. Now, we've got one-fifth of the Anzacs who are from the bush, one-fifth of the Anzacs who were born in the UK, and more than a fifth who are religious. But only one of those three elements makes it into the Anzac legend. And I think it's worth asking. I mean, we kind of treat the Anzac story now as a secular religion. Many, many historians and commentators call it that. But have we asked what was the spiritual nature of the Anzacs? Since we're interested in treating them as a kind of a spiritual force, what was their spirituality?
Maybe that dislike of public moralising, dislike of scolding, dislike of getting on your high horse about moral matters might have concealed that aspect of their lives.
Absolutely, and there's no doubt that the public face of the Anzacs was very secular. But then so was the British Army. Ironically, so was the American Army. We think of America as that hotbed of, you know, public religiosity. But no. And the Australians had brought with them from England this reticence to talk about the things that mattered most, at least in public. And so the good Aussie male was reticent about expressing emotions and deep feelings.
Let's look at the life of this man then, Walter Dexter. He was born near Liverpool, the port of Liverpool in the UK. How old was he when he first went to sea?
So he's 14 years old. His dad has desperately tried to get him a job in a bank. His two older brothers, much older than him, are at sea. And Dexter just wants the adventurous life at sea compared to tallying numbers in a bank.
So how does he get to sea at the age of 14?
Well, he signs a contract as an apprentice sailor. It would horrify us, the terms today. His wages were nothing plus washing. So he had his laundry done. Yes, that's right. He had his laundry done. He was obviously fed and housed on the ship. In port, he was given somewhere to stay and food, but he received no salary at all.
You say sailing. We are talking about a sailing ship here. This is the late 19th century, after all.
That's right. So it's the early age of steam navigation, but a lot of merchant marine is still sailing, and Dexter falls in love with sailing ships, with actual sails. They are his first and constant love.
And what was the life of a sailor's apprentice like in those days?
Oh, it was, we'd call it unbearable, but to them it was normal. So it was drudgery work, scrubbing decks, coiling ropes. It was nothing like his romantic imagination had fantasised. And in fact, his captain was a bully, so much so that in his first port of call, Mumbai today, Dexter deserted, which was a very major crime.
once he got ashore in India, what did he do with himself then? He's like 14 years old, 15 years old at this point.
That's right. So he's living on the streets as best he can. He's eating at sailor charities, but he gets caught, taken back on board ship and severely punished. But he escapes again and this time manages to evade attempts to recapture him. And he signs up on an American ship, which was probably happy to give refuge to this escapee from British tyranny, you know.
And what were conditions aboard this new ship, like this American ship?
Much better, much better. He was treated well. He was eventually signed on as a full crewman, so he was given all the privileges. And his captain at the end of the voyage gave him a very good reference. Dexter was keen, intelligent, willing, so he was an asset on board a ship.
So where did this American ship take him?
To New York.
Now, he's in New York City. At the age of 15 and alone, I assume, as well. Does he know anyone in New York? He can't know.
Not a soul.
Well, so what is he doing with himself as this 15-year-old kid walking around New York City?
I guess it points out something about his character and personality, but also something about the age, that it was nothing particularly unusual about a boy of his age being on his own on the other side of the world. Look, he gets a job. He gets a job in a biscuit factory. He finds himself somewhere to live. He ends up getting in a fight. He was always getting into fights. He was a bit of a pugilist and loses his job. So he gets another one running lifts in a hospital next to Central Park. He's enterprising and he gets by.
New York was an amazing place for an enterprising, driven young guy like him. But he doesn't stay there in New York, does he? He doesn't stay there. He gets on a ship again, captained by his brother this time, is that right?
That's right. So his brother calls into New York, he's captain, and I don't know how they reconnected, I don't know how the brother knew where he was. But by this stage, Dexter's been watching Wild West shows, you know, Barnum and all the fabulous lore of the Wild West. And
Buffalo Bill, Calamity Jane, all of those shows?
He'd probably seen Buffalo Bill and Calamity Jane in shows in New York. And he was about to head off to the Wild West when his brother said to him, "Why don't you sign up on my ship?" Which he did. So he goes back to sea.
And he goes all over the world. This must have made him a very worldly human being before he'd even reached 20.
Exactly. And this was the normal life of a sailor. He commented in his memoirs that his first trip out, you know, he learnt more about sex than most men would learn in a lifetime.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because that's the sailor's life, isn't it? When once you get ashore, it's paid sex and hard drinking. Did he do all of that?
He was not into sex and the drinking was very moderate. He learnt very quickly the dangers of alcohol and he found various strategies that allowed him to be companionable around the men who were drinking hard. So he would drink a little. The sex he was exposed to kind of would make us smile a bit. In Tacoma, in the US Pacific Coast, he watched a show where there was a skit about Adam and Eve in Eden, probably in their Edenic innocence, and then followed by another skit of a Mormon leading his latest wife over the sleeping bodies of the seven other wives. And, you know, that's about as daring as it got.
Saucy.
Yeah, saucy indeed. Dexter's definitely had the opportunity to do more, but I think there's very little evidence of his early life's attitudes, but it would seem that he had ethical standards that he held to, even on his own.
While he was at sea, how was he working to improve his mind and his prospects?
Many sailors just lived from day to day. It was a very existential life. But Dexter was ambitious, and so he literally learnt the ropes. He wasn't taught by his captains, but he taught himself seamanship. He learnt from the older sailors. And then he took up the study of the necessary qualifications to become a mate, which is an officer on a ship, and eventually a master, the captain of a ship. He taught himself mathematics, quite complex mathematics, to be able to deal with the navigation needed. And he found that he was not only good at it, but he actually loved it.
So I'm getting a picture of a man who's like not even 20 at this point, but he's still got a degree of drive and ambition and a fair degree of self-knowledge and self-possession.
Yes. For a young man, his self-awareness is extremely high. His ability to work with people is outstanding and he has a very fine mind.
1900, his life takes another sharp turn when he quits the sea to become a soldier in the Second Boer War in South Africa. Why this sudden radical change? What do you put it down to? Patriotism or ambition or boredom or what?
I think it's a cluster of things. So definitely patriotism. He was always a British Empire man, and that was not unusual for his era. He joins an Indian or a British Indian horse unit in India. I think it demonstrates his gift of the gab. How a sailor learnt to ride a horse well, and the requirement was you had to be an excellent horseman and a fine shot. He talks his way into this unit and becomes one of its leading members. It still astounds me. I think there was probably a hint of wanting to live his Wild West dreams in joining this adventure as well.
Serving as a scout with this unit, he won the Distinguished Conduct Medal. How did he do that?
We wish we knew for sure. We believe it was for climbing a telegraph pole and cutting the wires that was allowing the Boer units to communicate with each other.
Climbing a telegraph pole, it's like climbing a mast, isn't it?
It would have been simple for Dexter. And he's cutting these wires under fire from snipers who are trying to stop him doing that job. So we know he did that, but we're not exactly sure if that was the action that won him this medal.
1901, after a year in the Boer War, he returns to sea as the master now of an Indian steamer called the Afghan. He's based in Mauritius and he's looking over the Indian Ocean. He seemed to have a real love and affinity for the warm and beautiful blue waters of the Indian Ocean. His employer was a Muslim. How did he go with those kind of cultural and religious differences?
Look, he shows his broad-mindedness and his capacity to understand people who aren't like him. The language he uses is characteristic of the racism of the time. But he made allowances. He learnt to live and let live. He speaks of the extraordinary food experiences in his different stays across Asia, the Middle East and Africa. He would just eat what was put in front of him and he learnt to like it. Yeah, he was a flexible man while trying to maintain his own principles.
Open-minded by the standards of the day might describe him well, I think.
Absolutely, yes.
What kind of tropical creatures did he record were constantly climbing aboard his ships at this time?
So in port, there were the usual, you know, ants and cockroaches, but sailors were bringing on board pets, giant tortoises that were always in the way when you were moving around decks, a young gazelle with sharp horns that would headbutt anybody bending over, which was a common posture for sailors doing work.
Who brings a gazelle onto a ship as a pet? That's what I want to know.
How about a crocodile?
A crocodile?
A crocodile, which was anorexic, and they would prop its jaws open with an iron bar and throw in meatballs.
In Mauritius, he fell in love with a Creole woman named Frances Rohan. And this is a really sad little story here, but how brief was this little period of happiness in his life?
I'm not sure exactly when he meets her, but probably a year or so before they get married. And, you know, it's a beautiful marriage, but almost a year later to the day, she dies in childbirth, and so does the baby. And Dexter is locked up in quarantine on his ship in Port Louis. He's not allowed off the ship to be with her.
How do you think that awful catastrophe changed him?
I think it made him ask questions about what mattered most in life. He's lived a life of adventure, and as a sea captain, he's discovered ways of making money. He doesn't quite like his employer's lack of ethics about money making, but he was a little bit flexible himself in what he could do. He would bend rules and regulations, and he was earning £5,000 a year, which was a good fortune in those days. So he's got adventure, he's had romance, he's got money, but I think he starts to question what really matters in life, and it turns him back towards the spirituality of his childhood.
Well, yeah, you've said turns him back, but I don't ever get a sense of this spiritual life he'd had until this point.
That's right. It's very difficult to trace, but you find little evidences like he's alone in New York and goes to church every Sunday. Didn't have to. In his memoirs of cruising the Pacific as a sailor and as a mate, he talks at length about his encounters with the missionaries and noticing that the missionaries really made a dramatic improvement in the lives of the people in the South Pacific. And he contrasts that with the merchants who would denigrate the missionaries and go, they're destroying the people's culture and all this sort of stuff. But he said the merchants were the really corrupt ones. They were destroying people's lives. They were making them alcoholic. They were ripping them off financially. So you have this sense that while he doesn't talk much about religion or faith, he does have these religious moral standards that he's always held to.
He's lost a wife and infant child. In those circumstances, someone like him has to ask the question, why do terrible things happen to good people?
Yes.
Do you think there's more questions than answers in his mind at this time?
I don't think so. He's not a man who exposes his inner thinking very much. But from the way in which he lived his life, his worldview encompassed tragedy without necessarily challenging his belief in God.
So he's made all this money as a ship's captain. He's been through this awful ordeal. What's he working towards at this point?
He begins to think about becoming an Anglican clergyman. And so while he's at sea,
That's the most radical transformation you can think of. A rougher's guts ship's captain in the Indian Ocean to Anglican clergyman?
Yes, yes. This is the extraordinary bit. And no one's ever fully made sense of it. His kids were astonished by it. And they say, oh, look, it was on the rebound from his wife's death. Look, there's a four-year gap between his wife's death and him going to England to train for the clergy. So that's a long rebound in my books. It's not an impulsive decision. It's thought through. It's thought through so much that he teaches himself Hebrew, Greek, and Latin on board his ship.
So where does he go to study theology then to become a clergyman?
So he goes back to England and he studies at Durham University in the north.
Right. And how does he get on at Durham University, this sailor?
Quite well. So he's in the older bracket of students and he quickly becomes a leader amongst the students, leading debate teams. He was a very impressive public speaker. He got involved in sports, particularly rowing, as you'd expect for a sailor, and quite a scholar. His performance at the end of his first year was so great that he was awarded a scholarship for his second year.
After graduating with a master's degree, he gets several placements, but then he gets sent to Australia, and he pretty quickly becomes an Australian.
That's right. His favourite port in all the world was Melbourne.
What was that?
He doesn't elaborate, but certainly there's something about the way Dexter lives that resonates well with the typical Aussie, if you like.
So where do they place him once he arrives in Australia?
So he becomes a missionary. That was the term. He was sent as a missionary to Wonthaggi.
To the heathens of Wonthaggi.
The wild men of Wonthaggi.
The mining town in Victoria?
Well, it was a brand new mining town. It had just been established to give Melbourne a reliable source of coal. Most of the inhabitants lived in tents. And when Dexter arrived, his church was a tent and his vicarage was a tent.
So how did he get on in Wonthaggi?
Really well. I mean, this is a man who's learnt the art of leadership on board ships, and he's able to apply that very quickly to his parish in Wonthaggi, where he earns the respect and the admiration and the love of his congregation. He founds a scout club at his church and really works well with the children. He's quite well loved in this parish.
Then he falls madly in love. Madly in love with a woman named Dora Roadknight. Tell me about how they first lock eyes on each other, these two.
She's just graduated from Teachers College. She's 22. She's from the bush. And her mother's worried about how she'll get on with these rough kids in this bush school. So she gets her uncle to write a letter to the local Anglican clergyman saying, would you mind keeping an eye on Dory? So he goes to the train to meet her and out steps this beautiful 22-year-old in a lavender dress, and he is just smitten. Now, the interesting thing is that Dory is a very practical girl. She's not a romantic. She recognises him instantly. As a schoolgirl, a face had appeared before her, and it was his face. And she knew instantly that that was the man she'd marry.
Then he gets appointed to a parish in South Melbourne, very comfortable. Then a year later, they're married. How happy were they together, these two?
Look, it's blissful. This is a marriage that's romantic from beginning to end. They were so deeply in love, and many people comment about it. And within about a year, they have a son, Bill, and everything's looking wonderful.
Yeah, but How was Walter at managing his money?
Walter actually commented in his memoirs that sailors are hopeless with money because they never got to handle money on a day-to-day basis. They got paid at the end of their voyage, so they had these huge funds which they would go through rapidly and then be indigent until they got another ship.
So they live on nothing at all on the ship.
Yes.
They stockpile their wages. They get ashore. They blow it all. They live like a king for a week and then they're in the doss house.
And Dexter never learnt otherwise, even though he recognised the problems. It's one of the great ironies of his life. He's an intelligent man, and yet he's completely hopeless at managing money, and basically from the time he quits being a sailor, he's in debt for the rest of his life.
A year later, after settling and getting married in South Melbourne, World War I breaks out. Walter Dexter quickly signs up as a chaplain. Now, he's one of the first people to sign up. Again, this is... I wonder if the quiet life was getting to him in South Melbourne, or was it duty? What's your sense of this?
Yeah, look, definitely the quiet life was a worry. But there was a very strong sense of duty in those days, and duty was a very positive word. We kind of have a negative connotation on duty. But duty was what a man did, and a man didn't even have to consult his wife or family to do his duty. So Dexter signs up without telling Dorrie.
Oh. Dear. And then he's off to Egypt. What was the job description of a chaplain in those days? I'm thinking, when we see these people in the movies, you see them holding the hands of someone who's lost someone or just doing a lot of consoling. Was there more to the job than just consoling?
Yes. Well, look, there was no real job description. There were probably two expectations. One was to take church services on a Sunday. Church in the army was compulsory. But you got your choice between an Anglican, Catholic, Presbyterian slash Methodist or other Protestant denominations.
What about Jewish Australians like Sir John Monash? Did he have to go to church as well?
Yes, they did have to go to church. There was no real provision for Jews. Eventually, a Jewish chaplain was appointed, but the 2,000 or so Jewish soldiers had to make do as best they could when their chaplain wasn't around.
So there are some specific duties that aren't particularly time-consuming, so the chaplain can make up the job himself if he likes, to some
degree. Absolutely, yes. And it was between the chaplain's own vision and drive and what their commanding officer let them do. If the commanding officer was sympathetic and got on with them, they could do a lot. If the CO was anti-religion and anti the chaplain, they could make their life very difficult. So typically they would run entertainments for the soldiers. They'd organise concerts, sporting events. They would often censor the mail. They would act as the officer's treasurer for the mess. Presumably the clergyman was the most reliable of the officers. And so it was... define your own role, and the good chaplains, and there were many of them, like Dexter, would actually mingle with the men during the day, just being friendly and building relationships.
Now, Christian clergymen are specifically all about peace and forgiveness. That's the ideology that they're there to represent. Are they an awkward fit in times of war?
Definitely. And a number of chaplains comment on this. You know, one of them talking about the irony of being on a mission of war at Christmas as he's running the services. But these are also men who are raised within the British imperial ideology, which was, it viewed God, King and country as a kind of a unified entity. The sense that the British Empire had global dominance because God was enabling it to carry the Protestant gospel to the world. So they didn't necessarily see going to war as a conflict, especially against Germany, which was seen as a militaristic government, not a democracy. It was seen as liberal in its theology. And so it was a kind of a political religious crusade.
Were they seen as a bit effete as well in a very blokey military culture, these chaplains?
Absolutely. Religion at the time was seen as a feminine concern, and already churches were 60% women, 40% men.
So if you're there, you know, fighting to shoot and kill and you've got a lisping vicar next to you, then yes, then they don't quite fit in. But he wasn't quite that lisping vicar, was he?
No. And in fact, when you read the accounts of the chaplains, the one phrase keeps coming through over and over again, the emphasis on their manliness. Because religion was for sooks. But Dexter is a man's man. I mean, he's proved that in his life as a sailor and as a soldier. And so, yes, Dexter was not the cliched, you know, effete clergyman.
So he boards the ship across the Indian Ocean to Egypt, and they disembark in Egypt in December 1914, sent to a camp outside of Cairo, camping in the shadow of the pyramids. My God. I suppose for the men in his unit, the units around him, this would have been staggering, but it's nothing he hasn't seen before, is it, this sort of stuff?
Well, no, although he hasn't been to Egypt.
No, but he's seen the world.
He has seen the world, yes.
And what were the conditions like for this camp?
Well, they were primitive when they arrived. Nothing was done. They were sleeping on the bare sand until they got the tents pitched and, you know, cooking arrangements organised. And Dexter's extremely useful. His ability to conjure up things out of thin air is a real boon. He finds food for the soldiers and feeds the officers in his tent.
He joined the men in basic training exercises, marching for huge periods of time across the desert. He's joining the men on these marches, but he's quite a bit older than these men, isn't he?
Yes, he's twice the age.
So how is he managing all this, these hard, hard, long marches?
He wrote in his diary, "I'm going to have to become as hard as iron." And so he worked on his fitness. There's no doubt that some of the marches left him very, very weary and sore, but he insisted on joining the men. Chaplains didn't have to, but the better chaplains did that, and Dexter was there.
I think they were all expecting to be sent to France, but then the word came through that they were going to be sent to Gallipoli for the Dardanelles campaign. When the first battalions went ashore at Gallipoli, where was he?
He was on a ship. He had planned to go ashore, not with his battalion, which was in the third wave, but he wanted to go with the first wave. There was a very strict order given. No chaplains are to go ashore, and Dexter was watched, and so he wasn't allowed to go.
So then what was it like for him to see the shattered bodies of those first casualties brought aboard the hospital ship he was on?
It was a shattering experience for him. Now, he'd seen war before, but he's seeing, as you say, these wounded men coming ashore, and he actually recognises the body of one of his wife's relatives in the bottom of a ship who'd passed away.
You've got one of his letters in your book where he's writing about what that experience was like. I'd love you to read from his letter if you can.
Dexter writes in his diary, "While I write, I feel I want to cry. Shattered limbs, bullets in the head, through the body, and in every conceivable manner. And yet with a smile they will say to me, 'All right, doctor, tend to this other poor fellow first.' And all the time they are in pain with their bandages solid with stale blood. I wanted to bubble and cry and take them in my arms and soothe them, for their nerves were all racked as well as their actual wounds. Instead, I joked with them and made them laugh and gave them cigarettes to smoke while I pulled the hard bandage from the wounds. The grateful looks on their faces as the wounds were freshly dressed was something to remember."
Oh, there's so much in that. That's so moving to hear that. That feeling of deep emotion and horror, and yet the need to kind of smother that with good humour. I suppose for everyone's sanity, people felt they needed to do that. What do you feel and think when you read that?
Oh, it's deeply moving. It's one of the most moving things he's written. He's not a man prone to put his feelings on paper, but I feel there are points where his experiences are such that he can't do anything else. It's an attempt to deal with the horror and the grief and the trauma.
He was hearing stories about the perfect heroism of the Anzacs, how unflinchingly brave every single one of them were. He knew that wasn't true, though, didn't he?
He did. He was a realist. He got particularly angry. The hospital ship went to Egypt to drop off patients and then to Malta because there wasn't room in Egypt for all the wounded. And he's just appalled at the conduct of these wounded men in Malta. Some of them lightly wounded, their privileged behaviour, the arrogance with which they carried themselves, the breaking of every rule. He was really quite angry. And then he hears stories of soldiers on Gallipoli who had not gone to the front lines and attacked. They'd hidden in gullies. They'd taken refuge on the shore. And while Dexter believed exaggerated versions of that, there was truth in it.
Do you have no compassion for these men, though? I mean, I know they're letting down their comrades, but nonetheless, who can know how they're going to react in the face of all that horror and bombardment and death and bodies being cut open and splattered everywhere? Who can know?
I agree. And Dexter's a harsh judge. He's as harsh on others as he is on himself. He's got very high standards that he meets, and he expects those standards of his fellow chaplains, and some of them don't meet them. He expects them of the replacement soldiers who come to fill in the gaps. And he's quite damning of these men who come through. He feels they haven't got the stamina and the iron in their soul that the first recruits had. But the war proves him wrong. The war shows that they became effective soldiers.
The Battle of Lone Pine was a traumatic low point. This is when the war starts to get properly hellish, like he's never seen before. Mm. How did he describe those days?
He talks about sorting the living from the dead, stacked three or four deep in the trenches, of walking over bodies in order to get from one place to the other, because there was nowhere else to walk. The horror of hearing the wheeze of the air from a dead man's lungs get pushed out when you step on his chest. And the funerals. He was dreaming of dead bodies and funerals. It was so overwhelming.
When the evacuation of the peninsula was announced in December, how did he feel about that?
He was shocked, horrified, and he begged to stay. He wanted to stay to tend the graves of the men he'd buried. In fact, one of the initiatives he'd taken on Gallipoli was beautifying and regularising the cemeteries. He'd used his nautical skills to map every grave on the peninsula and then worked to make the cemeteries a place of honour for the dead.
Tell me about the gesture he performed on his last day on that peninsula.
So he walked through the cemeteries scattering wattle seed, Australian wattle seed that he'd soaked in water, because he wanted the dead to be shaded by their native trees. I've been to Gallipoli a few times. Unfortunately, none of those seeds seem to have taken. But what a gesture.
After Christmas, he was with his battalion on the island of Lemnos, and he was told he was to be awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his courage in retrieving bodies and aiding the wounded. Where does the DSO rank on the level of Australian honours?
So for bravery decorations, it's immediately below the Victoria Cross. It's what you give someone for outstanding leadership or extraordinary courage, particularly if the courage isn't quite VC standard. So you give them a DSO.
What did the troops make of him being awarded the DSO?
Oh, they were thrilled. He was modest. He kind of tried to play it down a bit. And by this stage, his desire for decorations has changed. He kind of sees through the futility of getting a medal for, you know, warlike actions. But, yeah, he's proud. He's really proud.
You say the troops called him, after he got the DSO, they called him Dirty Stop Out.
Yes. So, again, typical Aussie humour. And he loved that kind of humour. When the troops called him out, he comes back to Gallipoli after a short period of leave, and they jump out and call him, the dissolute old padre, you know, and he just loved being called that.
So being promoted to a senior chaplaincy role, he was then stationed in France. How much time did he spend on the front lines of those horrifying campaigns?
I have calculated that he spent more time than any other chaplain, and probably more time than the average soldier. So the average soldier, as I mentioned, about a third of their time would be at the front. I've counted the days Dexter spent at the front, and it's more than half of his time in France. He's actually at the front, in the trenches, mixing with the soldiers. Whenever there's a battle, he goes straight there, and he organises the work of the chaplains. He's working in the first aid posts. He's collecting the dead from no man's land, burying them, bringing up supplies, organising canteens under fire. It's an extraordinary achievement.
You've got him acquiring, once again that word, acquiring all kinds of things to raise the morale of the troops. He's setting up free coffee stalls, free soup stalls. And this is when he gets the nickname, the Pinching Padre, for his ability to acquire all this sort of stuff. One of the soldiers wrote a poem dedicated to him called The Pinching Padre. I'd just love you to read the first stanza from that, please, Daniel.
When you're short of pots for coffee and a redneck Johnny Toffee doesn't seem as if his kindness would evoke your warmest thanks, would you stand and look perplexed, or would you send for Padre Dexter? would you get the pinching padre to purloin some little tanks? Though the staff have glad regalia, there are fellows from Australia who do not regard its powers with a reverential awe. If the staff should offer inches, many L's the padre pinches, he's the sweetest little pincher that an army ever saw.
Sweetest little pincher that an army ever saw. That's tremendous. War comes to an end in 1918. He was in Paris when the armistice was declared. How did he feel about the end of the war when it finally came about?
Like many soldiers, there was a sort of a quiet, stunned sensation. The crowds in Paris were celebrating wildly, and he couldn't cope. He needed more of the soldierly British reserve, so he rushed back to his unit where he was able to quietly reflect with his men on the fact that this terrible carnage had come to an end.
What was he thinking he would do now that the war was over?
This was a great puzzle that he hadn't solved. Even in 1914, he'd written to Dorry saying, "I don't know how I will go after the war, after all this amongst men." And he kind of thought drinking cups of tea with old ladies. So when he returns to Australia in 1920, he actually takes up a soldier settlement farm.
He becomes a farmer.
Yes.
I detect there's a crisis of faith here, don't you?
Possibly, although there is no particular evidence for it. I wonder if he is still searching for adventure. In between the end of the war and becoming a farmer, he's desperately tried to join two world record flights, aviation flights, from England and America. I think he's trying to find something that will be challenging.
And test his ingenuity. So he buys this soldier settlement property in Kilsyth in Victoria. To me, what this sounds like is a man who's very intelligent, is a man who's a great many talents, who's succeeded in pretty much a great many different things. And he figured, well, I can be a farmer. How hard can it be? Is that pretty much what happened?
I think so. And it is the most disastrous failure of his life. He has no instinct for farming. He has no instinct for animals. And, of course, he's got no financial management skills.
And he's not grown up in that world either. You really do need to grow up in that world to know what's going on with a cow or a calf or a sheep or a chook or what have you, don't you? I mean, he's got nothing of that, does he?
No, 20 years at sea doesn't teach you much of that. This is probably my favourite Dexter story. He's inherited a cow when he buys the farm that is probably the worst milking cow you could imagine, everything you don't want in a milker. And he eventually sells it. And several months later, he comes back from the market leading its replacement. And his son looks at him in horror and says, "Dad, you've bought Annie again." And he goes, no, I'm not that stupid. It's Annie." He lets go of the halter and Annie walks straight to her old milking bale.
He bought the same.
The same disastrous cow.
But what did this failure do for his self-confidence then?
Again, his kids are guessing it destroyed him. They look at the 25 years afterwards where he didn't seem to take any initiative and they go, it destroyed his soul. I'm finding evidence that he's still got ambition bubbling away in the background. But I think at this point he recognises that with a growing family of kids, he needs to stop being the adventurer and start being the responsible adult.
So he's racking up massive amounts of debt on this farm. What made him decide to finally pull the plug on this property?
He was going broke. His wife was saying to him, "We can't continue," and he recognised that. So he humbly went back to the Archbishop and said, "Can I have a job?" So he's given a small rural parish, which was basically he was asked to start at the bottom again. He'd blown his credit with the church.
Why? How?
Well, the 4 years being a farmer, when he was so well known and could have been such an asset to the church. And I guess, you know, just because you come crawling back to the Archbishop doesn't mean there's a plum vacancy somewhere in Melbourne for you.
My God, that's so small-minded, isn't it? That's the old small-mindedness. He deserved better than that, surely.
He did deserve better, but I don't think he'd worked well with his bishop.
And so the rest of his life, this final third of his life, which had been filled with all that adventure and achievement and courage and compassion and enterprise and all those things, it becomes this massive anticlimax.
Massive. He's working in quiet country parishes, first at Romsey and then at Lara. He fires up on Anzac Day and Remembrance Day. He gets some luminaries in for his services, Lord Milne and Thomas Masefield, famous writer. So, you know, he's still trying things, but he's actually devoting his energies to raising his children in a very happy home and making sure they get the best education they can.
He has a lot of grand schemes that don't go anywhere, or he sort of begins and then stops and then picks up other things. And so nothing's ever completed, which earns him a kind of, he becomes a bit pathetic in the eyes of his kids for this. Am I making his Twilight seem too gloomy? This sad man who'd once been so consequential, so important, had become so, I don't know, inconsequential in the eyes
diminished.
Of people. Diminished?
Certainly diminished in the eyes of his children. But I think his self-esteem was still robust. He saw himself as doing something that was of value, not making himself big and famous, but making sure his kids got, you know, a good grounding in life. And he has these little attempts to try to do something for himself. For instance, he tries becoming an author. I think it's another get-rich-quick scheme to get out of his financial problems. He becomes a teacher at Geelong Grammar, and he's an outstanding teacher. He gets a teaching qualification, and he's extremely popular with the boys, who some of them mention to his sons that they never had a better teacher. But these careers don't blossom, and he continues in the clergy.
He was entertaining a madcap scheme at the age of 77, to captain a sailing ship to New Caledonia, and that's when he finally died. When he did die, what were the obituaries for him like?
Oh, they were extremely laudatory. He couldn't go anywhere in Victoria without being mobbed by former soldiers. There were ex-servicemen who were paying the fees of his children in Geelong Grammar. You know, he was still deeply, deeply respected and well-honoured across all of Victoria. And, you know, he tried to become a chaplain again in World War II. He wanted to be a chaplain to British internees in Nazi Germany. It tells me that the flame is still alive. He's still got this passion, this ambition to do things. And now that his kids are grown up, he thinks, I can do these things.
I don't know, if he was around today, we'd sort of celebrate him as a national treasure. I like to think that. He'd be sort of lauded and be asked to speak at places, and we'd, you know, bring him out on Australia Day, and we have him do all kinds of things for the country. But I wonder why his talents were so easily overlooked and so wasted. Was there something small-minded about Australia after the First World War? With the people who just wanted a quiet life, maybe?
Yes, people did want to forget the war. But again, he was widely celebrated, and especially after his death, the tributes pour in. But after a while, men like Dexter were easily forgotten. Other great chaplains, like the Salvationist William Mackenzie, who was a genuine celebrity in Australia for 20 years after the war, now virtually forgotten. And I put it down to probably that the Anzac legend has trouble fitting a devout clergyman into its narrative. And yet there they were. They were extremely popular with the troops, but not very popular with us who want to remember Anzac.
His kids, pretty much all of them, went on to have these very distinguished careers at the highest levels of the Australian public service. As they got older, did they begin to see their father more clearly?
Absolutely. They started reading the papers that he'd left behind, his letters, his diaries. They realised that they'd actually lived with an extraordinary man and not known it. Several of them visited Gallipoli and were deeply moved by that experience, and their opinion of their father changed. Geraldine writes, you know, I thought he was just dad. Everybody's got a dad. And she goes, he was this extraordinary man and yet deeply humble. I never knew he was that great.
When you met Walter's son, Mick, he was at the age of 100, like you said, and he told you that his dad was a bit of a loser. Once he read your book, were you able to change his perspective on his father?
Yes, yes. He told me, we spoke after he'd read the first drafts of the book, and he goes, I've had to change my opinion. He became aware that his father was not this pathetic figure that he'd sometimes painted.
After reading your book, I got the impression of a very loving man. Just one of those people with a lot of love in him, and was able to give it out to a whole lot of other people. And he was a man for whom, and I think it seems to me his Christianity was a way of giving that need to love, if you like, some kind of structure and some kind of ethical basis. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a tremendously compassionate man. He might have high standards and be quite judgmental in some ways.
But I think he's naturally compassionate, not ideologically compassionate.
That's right, naturally compassionate. And in the story of Christ, he finds a compassion that inspires him. And that's what drives him. There are several of his sermons that survive. I've read them. There's no hellfire and brimstone in them. You know, his kids speak about how fantastic his sermons were, how much they appealed to young people. And the text of his sermons is about love, is about how to live as a full human being and in a rich way.
He was a man who was preaching a certain set of ethics in wartime within a military that might have a different set of ethics. How do you see that conflict or contrast?
Look, it's common with all armies that soldiers develop a unique ethic for their situation. They're asked to do things that you're not supposed to do in civilian life. They're asked to kill people.
Yeah, and the soldiers feel the trauma of that, because there's something in nearly all of us that rebels at the taboo of taking life.
That's right. That's right. And Dexter is one of this band of soldiers who are going, we're in a unique situation. Our country has called on us to achieve this goal, but they haven't provided all the resources that we need. And so stealing, not reckless stealing, but purposeful stealing to achieve the goal was ethical. Killing the enemy was ethical. Looking after the wounded, both your own and the enemy, was sacrosanct. And soldiers develop this new ethic to cope with the unique and extraordinary circumstances in which they're placed. And Dexter shows that.
What an amazing story. I'd never heard of this guy before I read your book. I'm so glad to have met him through your book. Daniel, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Daniel Renner's book is called Sailor, Soldier, Vicar, Farmer, The Improbable Life of Anzac Chaplain Walter Dexter. Today's conversation with Daniel Renner was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Maggie Morris. The executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.